Welcome, everyone, to another Faith Unaltered and Real Seekers Clap. I'm your host, Tyler Fowler, along with Dale Glover, my co-host, David Russell, and our special guest for this evening, Dr. William Lane Craig, is joining us. Welcome, Dr. Craig. It is an absolute honor to have you with us. We are going to be discussing the philosophy of time. And with that being said, I just want to go ahead and get into my first question. Because I'm really excited to get this party rolling. So for those who may not know you, Dr. Craig, can you take a couple minutes to introduce the audience as to who you are, your background, and perhaps share a little bit about your own faith journey as well?
Certainly. I am a Christian philosopher and theologian and the president of an online ministry called Reasonable Faith at the website reasonablefaith.org. I became a Christian my junior year in high school through the witness of a girl who sat in front of me in my German class and who shared with me the love of God that prompted me to begin to read the New Testament. And I was so captivated by the person of Jesus of Nazareth that after 6 months of just intense soul searching, I yielded my life completely to Christ and dedicated my life to living for him. And since then, I've gone on to pursue doctoral degrees in philosophy at the University of Birmingham in England and in theology at the University of Munich in Germany. And we currently carry out a ministry of sharing the gospel while providing an intellectual defense of the Christian world and life view.
All right. Thank you so much for that. David, do you want to go ahead and take question number two?
Well, it's very nice to meet you, Dr. Craig. You know, longtime fan. You've had the most impact out of any Christian in my life and walk. And wow. It's your ministry, Reasonable Faith. I mean, I even got the book right here that propelled me into getting my master's in apologetics and philosophy and with a bachelor's in theology. So, Excellent. Yeah, still on my thesis there. I'm doing the problem of evil. So, but thank you for your ministry and everything like that. And I know we're talking about time and God. So I am going to switch over to that and ask you if you can take some time to describe like some main philosophical positions on the nature of time with respect to the universe itself, such as McTaggart's no time or timeless view, presentism, you know, like A theory is kind of based off that, static eternalism, B theory, or hybrid possibilism, because my mind's blown when I think about time, you know, like, I'm like, are my thoughts bound by time? You know, things like that. You know, it just puts you down the rabbit hole. So if you could just discuss that, I would appreciate it.
My study of the nature of time was motivated by my desire to understand God's eternity. And certainly the subject of time is more difficult and mysterious than any other subject apart from the existence of God. And so you put God and time together into the same mix, and you've got a subject that you can spend the rest of your life studying. Well, now, there are many different ways to understand the nature of time, but one of the most important has to do with the objectivity of tense. That is to say, past, present, and future. Are these real, objective, mind-independent features of reality, or are they merely subjective illusions of human consciousness? And various theories of time treat these tense determinations differently. For example, you mentioned the A theory of time. This is a theory of time that says that these tense determinations are objective features of the world, that there really is such a thing as the present moment, and that it has a different ontological status than a past moment or a future moment. And that temporal becoming is a real and objective feature of the world. Things really do come into being and go out of being. So that's the A theory. The B theory, by contrast, says that temporal becoming is illusory. It's just a feature of human subjective experience, and that there really is no objective difference between past, present, and future. It just is a perspective of the observer. For the people in 2024, 2024 is present. But for the people in 1924, 1924 is present. And neither one of them is objectively right. It's just a matter of a person's perspective. And so on the B theory, there is no temporal becoming. All events in time are stretched out like a line, equally real, and past, present, and future just shows your relative position on the time line. Now, you can try to merge these two together into a sort of A hyphen B theory, a kind of marriage between the two. But I and many others have argued that this is really incoherent. You cannot marry a tenseless, B-theoretic ontology with the objectivity of tense and temporal becoming. Otherwise, you'll wind up with a contradiction. And it was precisely that contradiction that led the famous idealist philosopher J.M.E. McTaggart to conclude that therefore time doesn't exist, that it's all unreal. He thought that time is a fundamentally contradictory notion. So you've got the A theory, the B theory, the contradictory mixture of the two, and then McTaggart's view that time is unreal.
So don't ask McTaggart what time it is.
Yeah, right.
Awesome. So yeah, I want to kind of go into the next question is, great, so you've kind of laid out what the various positions are. Now we want to find out, but what is Dr. Craig's position? And you are well known for taking the same theory that I do, the A theory or the presentism mm-hmm. view. Mm-hmm. So do you want to just take some time to kind of lay out what do you think are some of the best arguments in favor of this view?
Well, I think that fundamentally, the best argument for the A theory of time is the presentness of our experience. It seems to me that we experience temporal becoming and the presentness of our own experiences, and that there is no defeater that would justify being skeptical about the fact that we apprehend the presentness of our own mental experiences. Indeed, it's hard to see how we could be mistaken about the presentness of our own experiences. And this experience of presentness is manifested in our language. Tense, as most of us are familiar with it, is a feature of language. And the attempt to remove tense from language inevitably results in loss of meaning. And I think that that is simply indicative of how deeply rooted in our experience this experience of the presentness of experience is. So it would be similar to our experience of the extra world. We have a powerful experience that there is a world of physical objects around us. And for that to be defeated, for us to be skeptical about the external world, you would need an enormously powerful argument that would defeat that experience. Now, if you think about it, the experience of presentness is even more powerful than your experience of the external world. For a while, you might be a brain in a vat and the external world be illusory. You cannot be guilty of having an illusion of the presentness of your own experience because you experience a change in the contents of consciousness, which is undeniable. So even the illusion of change would itself be changing. And so I think that the presentness of our mental experiences is even more real, more undeniable and veridical than our experience of the external world.
I do have a couple follow-up questions. One just real quick that's not on the list, just real quick. I'm kind of curious, when you mentioned about it's an experience type thing, do you think it's kind of akin to an experiential knowledge, or would you say it's kind of grounded in a properly basic belief?
I think it is a properly basic belief that is grounded in my experience of the presentness of my own mental experiences. Just as my belief in the external world is a properly basic belief grounded in my experience of the external world, so my belief in the objectivity of tense is a properly basic belief grounded in my experience of the presentness of my experience.
Awesome. All right, cool. And one last follow-up. So in your book, Time and Eternity, there, you do mention a couple of other arguments, such as the illusion of becoming, temporal becoming, and the problem of intrinsic change. But you mentioned that these count as arguments against the static eternalism, or against the B theory of time, rather than for the A theory. So I just wanted to get your take. Like, do you think that these kinds of things could be used as positive arguments for the A theory in their own right? Or is there a reason they only count against the B theory type deal?
I think they could be used as arguments positively for the truth of the A theory. It's just that the argument from the presentness of experience is a positive argument, whereas these other arguments prove the A theory by falsifying the B theory. And so they're more negative arguments. So if you have two positions, A and not A, you can establish A by proving not A. So yeah. I would say that these arguments against the B theory provide good reasons for the A theory. And some of those arguments, as you may recall from the book, are actually theological, not philosophical. I think we have really powerful theological arguments for affirming the A theory of time and the objectivity of tense and temporal becoming.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Tyler, over to you for the next question there.
All righty, Dr. Craig. So I'm really interested in modern science. And the next question we have for you is, well, what about modern science? Hasn't Einstein's relativity theories proven that eternalism or B theory of time is true?
This is a popular misconception that is unfortunately very widespread. And I think it comes due to the textbook presentation of relativity theory in terms of a four-dimensional space-time geometry. But that is simply a way of presenting the theory diagrammatically. You use a four-dimensional geometry to present the theory, but it shouldn't be construed as a serious piece of metaphysics. Historically, there have been at least three main interpretations of special relativity. The first was Einstein's original 1905 paper, where he represented special relativity in terms of an A theory of time with three-dimensional objects enduring through time. In 1908, the physicist Hermann Minkowski showed that the theory could be much more simply presented in terms of this four-dimensional geometrical presentation. And so he proposed this space-time interpretation of special relativity, which Einstein then adopted and became then the standard textbook way of explaining the theory to students. But in addition to this, there was H.A. Lorentz's view, which was that relativity is a feature of the subjective perspective of the various finite observers in space-time who are in motion relative to a fundamental reference frame. And since uniform motion affects the speed of one's clocks, that affects how different observers in motion will measure the amount of time elapsed. So on Lorentz's view, there is absolute time, absolute length, absolute motion, but these are simply undetectable by us through our measuring instruments. So those are three alternative ways of presenting the theory. They are empirically equivalent and therefore cannot be adjudicated simply on the basis of empirical evidence. Although I do hasten to add that in recent decades, there has been very dramatic evidence coming out of quantum theory that tends to support Lorentz's interpretation over Einstein's or Minkowski's. But our listeners need to understand that there are various physical interpretations of the same mathematical core of the theory. The mathematical equations are the same in every case. It's just that there are three different physical interpretations of the theory. And Lorentz's and Einstein's were both fully compatible with the objectivity of tense and temporal becoming.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. David.
Go ahead, Dale.
Just a very quick follow-up. We do have time, so to hog the limelight. But Dr. I am kind of interested. That was something that was interesting to me, finding out that really the reason why people prefer one interpretation of relativity over another is it's mainly philosophical in nature. But there was that aspect where you mentioned there's some empirical evidence that actually seems to favor the neo-Lorentzian view. And I forget what it is. It Bell's theorem?
Yes, Bell's theorem and the so-called EPR experiment.
Do you mind taking a couple minutes to explain that for people? Because I think that's important.
The EPR experiment involves sending two photons in opposite directions into space. And then you perform a measurement on one of the photons. And quantum theory requires that the other photon automatically and immediately takes on the correlating value. Now, no causal signal could be propagated from the measured photon fast enough to reach the other photon, which is receding at the speed of light. And therefore, you've got a real problem here because it seems to imply absolute simultaneity. If you continue to hold to relativity theory in the face of the EPR experiment, what it implies is that in some reference frames, you would have signals going backwards in time. They would be received before they were sent, which is pathological. So in order to avoid these backward signals in time, the best interpretation is Lorentz's, to say that there is a relation of absolute simultaneity. This is disclosed in the EPR experiments, even if we cannot determine exactly what that time is.
Gotcha. Thank you so much. Over to you, David, for the next question.
Well, this is going to be a fun question because we've been serious to this point. So I just had this nagging question. I've been listening to Defenders for years, right? And in the beginning, it says Johnson's Ferry Baptist Church.
Oh.
I just have to know, is it the Johnson Ferry Baptist Church that's off of Johnson Ferry Road in Georgia?
Yes.
I used to drive by there all the time. My family was from Marietta down there.
Oh.
And yeah, so like we used to drive on Johnson Ferry Road all the time. And I think that is the church that my aunt first got saved in that I went to when I was really, really little.
Oh, isn't that remarkable?
Isn't that something?
That is the church at which I teach my Defenders class every Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m.
It's such a small world when you actually think about it, you know? Yeah. It's like I grew up watching Braves games in the 90s, you know, going down there every summer and stuff like that.
Oh, that was exciting.
Oh, yeah. I was originally – I'm from the metropolitan area in D.C. You know, I live in Northern Virginia. But every summer, that's where my dad lived. So I would be down there watching that. So it just thought I'd ask because I still was passing by it at, like, at least, like, a ton of times when I was growing up, you know, and just seeing it. That's just wild. So yeah, I just had that nagging question.
We loved watching Greg Maddux pitch and John Schmoltz and others. Oh, yeah. It was a great team.
Otis Nixon. I was at the game where Otis Nixon made that crazy catch up the side of the back there. But yeah. Wow. So, man, that was a time ago, right? Yeah. Anyways, Dr. Craig, philosophers and theologians, they traditionally identified two basic modes in which, like, God himself can be said to be eternal. And my question is around either he is eternally temporal or he's eternally timeless. I've always had that kind of question in my head. And you're known for a unique view whereby you think God was eternal in both senses. And can you explain your view why you think that is true? How does that work exactly?
The view is a kind of hybrid view of timelessness and temporality. It is admittedly very strange when you first hear it, but the more I thought about it, the more I tried to expose flaws in it, the more I became convinced that it is coherent. And the view is basically this, that God is timeless, existing alone without creation, but temporal since the moment of creation. So he's timeless sans creation, but temporal with creation. And there are a number of reasons, I think, that you can give. One would be that there cannot be an infinite regress of events in time. If there cannot be an infinite regress of events in time, you have to get back to a first moment of time and an absolutely first event. And since God didn't come into being at that moment, that implies that in some difficult to understand way, he must have existed beyond the first moment of time. He existed without creation in a timeless state because there were no events. This view also has the advantage of avoiding the otherwise insoluble question, why didn't God create the world sooner? If time goes back infinitely, then at any point in time, God has waited for an infinite amount of time to create the world. And why would he do that? There's nothing that could distinguish the moment of creation from any other moment in an infinite regress of moments that would make it an appropriate moment to create the world. But if time begins at the moment of creation, then that question becomes meaningless. You cannot ask, why didn't God create the world sooner? Because time begins with the first event, with the creation of the universe. There is no sooner. So that's the view that I hold to and I think is biblical and makes the most sense.
I just have a quick follow-up, Dr. Craig, and if you just mentioned it, forgive me, I missed it, but can you give the main reason why you don't believe there can be an infinite regress, or just summarize if you didn't mention that?
In my work, I have defended four arguments for the finitude of the past. The first would be the impossibility of the existence of an actually infinite number of things. Okay. You can show very easily that if there is an actually infinite number of things, this leads to all sorts of absurdities that I would say are metaphysically impossible. But an infinite past would involve an actually infinite number of things, namely an actually infinite number of events. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there cannot be an actually infinite past. Mm-hmm. Another argument would be that even if you could have an actually infinite collection of things, such a collection could not be formed by successive addition. You cannot form an infinite collection by adding one member after another, one at a time. Sometimes this is called the impossibility of counting to infinity. For any number you count, you can always count one more before you arrive at infinity. And so you never reach infinity. Now, if the past is infinite, that means that it would be like counting down from infinity. It would be like counting down all the negative numbers by never beginning, but ending at zero, which seems like an even more absurd task. So if you cannot form an actually infinite collection of things by successive addition, and on an A theory of time, mind you, the past has been formed by successive addition, one event occurring on the heels of another, then it seems to me to follow that the past must be finite. Those are the philosophical arguments. This receives dramatic scientific confirmation from Big Bang cosmology, which says that physical space and time, all matter and energy, began in the Big Bang. It was an absolute beginning before which nothing existed. And then secondly, the confirmation from the thermodynamic properties of the universe, which indicate that the universe cannot have existed from infinity past. It must have begun in a low entropy state at some time in the finite past and has now been running down toward equilibrium. So those would provide scientific confirmation of the purely philosophical arguments for the finitude of the past.
Okay, thank you. So if somebody affirms an infinite regress, then not only are they denying philosophical arguments, they're denying scientific arguments as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Fair enough. Thank you for that.
And one thing, since this is on the topic of time, I just want to clarify something. And Bill, you can confirm if I'm right. But in terms of those arguments, the first philosophical argument and the scientific evidence are neutral. They prove the universe began to exist regardless of which theory of time you go for. It's really only that second. Am I getting that wrong or am I right? It's only the second
one. You are correct. It is the second argument based on the impossibility of forming an actual infinite by successive addition that presupposes an A theory of time. But the first philosophical argument and the two scientific confirmations are perfectly compatible with a B theory of time. Yes.
Awesome. So I'm on the right track, but yeah, David, I know you have a follow-up there.
Yeah. This is a, just one real quick that does, you know, it gives you, like I said, I'm diving down the rabbit hole here in some way, but does that kind of make it that we can't really, I guess, comprehend or apprehend eternity in that aspect, you know, because you're speaking about momentlessness, you know, and I was just wondering like how, can we even understand that at that point?
how
God exists.
Are you asking, can we understand what it would be like to be in a timeless state?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Now, we may not be able to imagine that, but I think we can certainly conceive it. To give an analogy, I cannot imagine a 1,000-sided figure, but I can conceive of a 1,000-sided figure. And in the same way, even if I can't imagine being timeless, I think it's pretty obvious to conceive it means a perfectly changeless state in which nothing happens. It is a static, stable state that has no before and after.
Okay, thank you. Because it's going to lead into, I think, the next series of questions there.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dale. I think it's you're up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So my thing is just a very quick question, but it's something. So I know David has connections with Hugh Ross. We've had Hugh Ross on the show, and he brings up this issue of hypertime.
Yeah.
Perhaps God exists in a hypertime dimension. Yeah. And I just wanted to get your take on that. If that's so in the first place, what do you think Hugh means by that? But beyond Hugh, if we take this literally, what would that entail? Like, could that be a plausible option for explaining God's relationship to time, that he exists in a literal hypertime dimension?
I don't think adding a second time dimension does anything to help. It simply kicks the problem upstairs, and then you've got to ask the same questions all over again. Is hyper time tensed or tenseless? Is it an A theory or B theory of time? Did it begin to exist, or is it infinite in the past? And the whole debate replays itself over in the hyper temporal dimension. So I think that the postulation of hyper time is metaphysically gratuitous, and it doesn't accomplish anything. It doesn't augment our explanatory power at all.
Awesome. All right. So, David, this was, believe it or not, this was your question. You kind of asked this a bit, but you can go into a bit more detail with question 7 there.
Yeah, that brings me back to this whole type of changelessness. Like, you know, we know God's relational, you know, and that he exists in a Trinity. And if he's changelessness, if that changelessness exists, and relationships we know are based off of, you know, interactions of you know, some sort, doesn't the fact that, like, sans creation, God still has various types of knowledge, thoughts, relationships between the divine persons of the Godhead, and even committed in an act, the act of creation itself, which can involve logical sequencing logically, wouldn't this entail like a chronological process or sequence as well to, like, knowledge and you know, relationship, you know?
Yes. All right. Now, there's a number of questions embedded in your single question.
Yes.
First, I agree that the act of creation would introduce change and time. And that's why I think that at the moment of creation, when God creates the universe, he enters into time. So I do agree with that part of the question. But you should not think that a logical sequence implies a chronological or temporal sequence. I think that's very evident. Think of the sequence of the natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That is a mathematical sequence, but it's not a chronological sequence. The number 2 is before the number 3 in the mathematical sense of being less than, whereas number 3 is after the number 2 in the sense of being greater than. But the relation of less than and greater than between numbers is not the same thing as chronologically before and chronologically after. So you mustn't think that just because you have a logical sequence, this implies a chronological sequence. That's easy to give counterexamples to. Now, I think, in answer to your main question, that the doctrine of the Trinity actually illuminates and helps the understanding of God existing timelessly. The biblical picture of God without creation is not that God is a lonely person all by himself, twiddling his thumbs, waiting to create the world. Rather, in the fullness of the divine life, God is tri-personal, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in a relationship of mutual knowledge, love, and will that is changeless and perfect, and therefore need never change. There is a complete interpenetration of the three persons of the Trinity in terms of mutual knowledge, love, and will that exists timelessly. And a human analogy for this would be when we think of two lovers who sit just staring into each other's eyes, saying nothing, and we sometimes say they were lost in that timeless moment. And I think that that is analogous to the way the three persons of the Trinity exist sans creation. There's just a timeless, full, unchanging, perfect, interpenetration of knowledge, love, and will between these three persons with no need whatsoever to create human persons for company.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Craig.
Well,
go ahead.
That helps me understand it a little bit better. That was a great analogy.
I have, I have a follow-up on that. Were you going to ask the next question, Tyler? Or?
No, I was gonna follow up too, but go ahead, Dale.
Okay, cool. So this is something that you said, and this is something that's fascinated me, and I should have asked this in the creation and time section, but the endurance of now, right? Because how long is it? If only the present moment exists, what is that? What equal, you know, psychologically speaking, I think they've said human beings, it's about 2 seconds. That's the present for human beings psychologically. But
that's called the specious present. That means that our neural brain processes are not fast enough to discern distinct events that are less than a certain interval of time. And so there is a kind of minimal interval that varies from person to person that is called psychologically the specious present. But that's a purely psychological trait that is a function of the speed of neurological signals in our brain.
So what is the ontological, like how would you answer the ontological
question? Right. Yeah. That's the difficult question. And here I must confess that I think this is the most difficult challenge for a tensed theory of time and for presentism. How long is the present? You could say, well, time is made up of discrete time atoms. These are usually called chronons, so that there is an interval of time, a little tiny time atom or chronon, and that these succeed each other one after another. The uncomfortable implication of that, however, is that time is jumpy rather than continuous. It sort of leaps from one chronon to the next without anything going on in between. And that certainly makes me feel uncomfortable to think that reality is jumpy in that way. So you might say, well, let's say then that time is continuous. Between any point in time, there's always another point. And that therefore time is composed of an infinite number of points. And these are called instants. Instants are zero durational intervals of time. Sometimes they're called degenerate intervals of time because they have no positive measure. They are zero in terms of their length. And so you could say that time is composed of instants and that there is a present instant and then there's a later instant and then a later instant. The difficulty, I think, with that view is that it seems impossible to explain temporal becoming because there cannot be a succession of instants because instants have no immediate successor. Between any instant and another instant, there's always an infinite number of intermediate instants. And so if you ask, what is the instant after the present instant? There is no answer to that. That it's an open interval with the present instant as a boundary. And this is the stuff of paradoxes of motion. Like, for example, at what point does someone leave the grocery store and go outside? Up to that boundary line, he is always in the store. But if he crosses the line, then he's outside the store. So when does he leave the store? Well, there is no instant at which he leaves the store. Any instant will either be outside the store or it will be an instant inside the store, but there is no instant at which he leaves the store. So this idea that time is composed of instants is really difficult. So here's my tentative solution. I think it's pretty good, but I'm not going to die on this hill. And that is this: the expression, the present, is malformed. Mm-hmm. It is meaningless. You always have to specify what you're talking about as present? The present century, the present minute, the present second, the present session of Congress, the present inning of the ball game. In other words, the expression the present is incomplete and therefore has no referent. You always have to specify the present what. And once you do that, then it is very easy to answer the question, what is the duration of the present? The present minute is 60 seconds long. The present hour is 60 minutes long. The present century is 100 years long. So I think that if we think of the notion of the present as a grammatically incomplete expression, it only refers to something when you fill in the present blank with some sort of a referring term.
Wow. Awesome. So before I just go to, I'll just say that's this. Huge.
What do you think of that solution?
That's deep.
I will tell you this, Craig, this will make you happy, Bill, because I copied your idea. I took a grad seminar on Parmenides, in historical philosophy, and I submitted this to my professor and I got an A. So that said something. So there's merit to it, right? So but yeah, Tyler, I know you had a follow-up. So yeah, over to you.
Yeah, just to go back, and this won't be as deep, I promise, but just to go back to what you and David were discussing, Dr. Craig, about logical sequencing and in telling chronological process. So I've actually brought up, we've had Warren McGrew and Dr. Alan Rhoda both on the show before to discuss dynamic omniscience or open theism. And they brought up the fact that, you know, action involves chronological sequence. And I asked them, well, you know, the Nicene and Constantinopolitan Creed talk about Jesus being begotten of the Father. And it seems like that is an act, that begetting is an act, and yet that wouldn't involve chronological sequence because it would seem like Arianism is entailed if that were the case. I was just curious what your thoughts are about God begetting.
I think you're absolutely correct about that. Okay. For those who want to affirm the Trinitarian processions, these are surely not temporal processions like water running out of a spigot. This has to be a timeless procession. And that's exactly what the creeds affirm. They say of the Son, begotten of the Father before all ages. Mm-hmm. So they are thinking here of a timeless procession of the Son from the Father and the Spirit, from the Father and the Son. Now, I know at least Rhoda is Catholic. What did they say in response to your question?
So Warren said, and now I think Rhoda has actually changed a little bit. So he affirmed that he was more on the Orthodox side of things now. But Warren would have said that begetting is more of an eternal act. And I don't think that's necessarily correct, so he might have misspoken whenever he said that, because it seems at that point he would have said that, or what he would have meant anyway, is that God the Father is always begetting Jesus, and that's just not what the creeds affirm.
Right, you can't use the word eternal. That's inherently ambiguous. The question is it eternal in the sense of timeless, which is the classic understanding, or is it eternal in the sense of omnitemporal, that there's been an infinite regress of events of in the begetting of the Son.
Right. And I would just affirm, you know, that this act does not entail chronological sequence and can't because, like you said, infinite regress, and then Arianism would be the only valid interpretation at that point.
Well, it would certainly make the Son look like a creature, wouldn't it?
Very much so. Very much so. All right. Thank you for that.
You know what's really interesting, though, is like when we're talking about the logical sequencing and stuff, that the last question I had, you know, it kind of puts I look at it, and this was an analogy that I always tried to do to Dr. Craig, is to look at it like inflation, you know, as inflation kind of like expands and making reality. That's how the time thing that you and Dale were talking about, like, you know, is the guy outside the door or is he still inside the thing? And it's like, that's kind of how I would see it. But even that breaks down at some point, you know? So it's just, it just really blows my mind how deep this stuff can go.
Yes, yes. These are deep, deep paradoxes that have puzzled people for millennia, actually. But I think that the distinction between a logical order of things mm-hmm. and a chronological order of things is quite clear. And this is clear to theologians. For example, Reformed theologians will often talk about the logic of God's decrees. This is the debate between supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism. Is God's decree of election logically prior to his decree of the fall? Or is the decree of the fall logically prior to his decree of those he's going to elect? They're quite different in terms right. of their logical relations, but no one would think that the order of these decrees is chronological. At first, God right. issued one, and then a little while later,
yeah.
he issued the other.
Right. Right. And that's what I've always said to people, like, for just from my, cause I haven't dug into the time stuff. It's always been, you know, I've been on other things, but, the aspect of, omniscience and time and how they work together is probably one of the biggest things that created this whole divide about Calvinism and Molinism and stuff like that. What do you think? You think that could be a possibility?
There are those who think that if you believe in an A theory of time, that then it's impossible for God to foreknow the future. Because they are presupposing a model of divine cognition that I call a perceptual model of divine cognition. That is to say, God looks into the future and sees what is going to happen. And this model is explicitly expressed when people talk about God's foreseeing the mm-hmm. future rather than foreknowing the future. And I think that perceptual model is quite mistaken, that we shouldn't think of God's cognitions in terms of perception. Rather, we should have a conceptual model in which God simply has essentially and innately the property of knowing only and all true propositions. And there are true propositions about the future, ergo, God knows only in all true future tense propositions. And so that gives him foreknowledge. It has nothing to do with looking into the future and seeing what's right. going to happen.
Absolutely. Right. Awesome. All right. All right, Dale, I'll kick it to you.
Oh yeah. I think Tyler has one last question, but we do have lots of audience questions. So I do want to make sure we have some time. We do have a 1 hour limit just so the audience knows. So after this, we'll try to get to as many audience questions as we can.
Right. And keep in mind, audience members, if you super chat us the question, those will take priority over all the other questions. So if you want your question answered, super chat us. You can do that by clicking the dollar sign down at the bottom of the video and just follow the on-screen instructions from there. So, okay, Dr. Craig, my last question is, and it really goes hand in hand with what we've been discussing now. We're going to actually have Warren and Dr. Rhoda back on the show to discuss the scriptural proofs for dynamic omniscience and open theism. I'm just curious, in your view, what do you think are the best arguments against dynamic omniscience or the open theist view of God and of time?
Well, biblically speaking, I think it's an open and shut case, frankly, because when you get to the New Testament, there is a whole series of words in the Greek for foreknowledge, namely pragnosko, to foreknow, pragnosis, foreknowledge. It's explicit in the New Testament that God has foreknowledge. And there are a whole series of these words with the PRO or pro prefix, pra martureo, to foretell, praorizo, to foreordain, praorao, to foresee.
Right.
So there's a whole system of these words designating God's knowledge of the future. And I remember talking with Timothy O'Connor, a Christian philosopher, once, and I said, Tim, How can Christian philosophers deny divine foreknowledge when it's explicitly taught in the New Testament? And he laughed and he said, oh, Bill, you know Christian philosophers don't care what the Bible teaches.
Oh, wow.
And we had a good laugh, but I tell you, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. A lot of these fellows just make up their minds based on philosophical arguments and never care to submit it to the authoritative teaching of Scripture. Now, in addition to this vocabulary that I just mentioned, then, of course, there are all sorts of examples of foreknowledge of highly contingent events in the Bible, such as the betrayal of Judas or the threefold denial of Peter before the cock crows twice, all sorts of these highly contingent events that you can point to that display God's foreknowledge of the future.
Thank you for that. I'm going to bring those passages up whenever we talk to Warren and Alan and see what they say. So,
yeah, see what they say. And don't let them get away with saying, well, Jesus knew Peter's weak character and knew that he couldn't be faithful, because that doesn't explain how he would know Peter would deny him three times before the cock crows twice.
Right. Very explicit instead of, you know, because I know they will say things like, well, God knows what he's going to do in the future, sure. Right? But this Fair is much. About Peter and a rooster that crows. So yeah, not necessarily.
Kind of like right that on. Big chicken down there.
Yeah. All right. So
I had moreover, just had one more thought.
Yeah.
It's a sinful deed by Peter, and therefore cannot be caused or predestined by God.
Amen. Thank you for that. That's really good.
Awesome. All right, cool. So I think what we'll do, we've got about 8 minutes. Maybe each one of us select one question from the audience and then we can close out. So, all right. So I'm going to select this one from Lord Have Mercy. Their question is about relativity. They're asking, if the passage of time feels the same for someone moving at extremely high speeds, then how does special relativity not logically imply determinism, since we could, quote unquote, fast forward people?
It doesn't do anything to imply causal determinism. It is true that because our biological clocks slow down as well as the mechanical clocks, the observer who's traveling at a near light speed relative to someone else can't detect it. But there's nothing there that would imply determinism. Now, maybe what he's thinking is that on a four-dimensionalist view, these events are already out there. They exist, but that's four-dimensionalism. And what I'm suggesting is that on Einstein's original view and on Lorentz's view, you don't have that kind of determinism where the events exist and are out there somehow embedded in their space-time coordinates.
Gotcha. Perfect. All right, David.
Another one. I'm still looking over them.
All right. Tyler, you go.
All right. I was still looking, but that's okay. I will go with David's question here. He asks, what do you think, Dr. Craig, about Ryan Mullen's ideas about time in relation to God? Ryan Mullen's, for those who don't know, is another open theist. And so I'm curious about this as well. So go ahead, Dr. Craig.
I didn't know he denied divine foreknowledge of the future.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
I agree with Ryan's critique of divine simplicity, impassibility, and immutability. But if you read his book, he doesn't present any arguments against divine timelessness as such. He thinks that these attributes come as a package deal. And so if you refute simplicity, immutability, and impassibility, you've refuted timelessness as well. And that's simply incorrect. These attributes are not mutually entailing. And therefore, he needs to present independent arguments against divine timelessness. And I'm not aware that he's done so. I've interacted with him in print. We've published articles responding to one another. Sure, and sure. I don't think that he has had any compelling objection to the view that God is timeless, sans creation, and temporal from the moment of creation.
All right. We're going to try to get him on as well. And so if he decide to come on, I'll ask him about it. All right. Thank you for that. David, over to you, brother.
All right. Is time meaningless without, this is from Mr. Jetty 89. Is time meaningless without the particles able to measure it? Some people think that time only advances when the wave function collapses again and again, but not really between those moments.
I think that the greatest physicist of all time, Isaac Newton, correctly distinguished between metaphysical time or time itself and our physical measures of time. And too often in secular thinking, these are collapsed together or conflated. And the use of clocks or measuring devices or particles to define operationally time and temporal sequence at best concern what I'd call physical time. Time as it plays a role in physics, but it does not define time itself, which I think is a metaphysical entity, which God experiences and knows, and that physical time is merely the effort of us poor, finite observers to do the best we can in providing physical measures of time.
Awesome. Well, all right. Dale. Yeah, cool. So I think that does it. I'm going to stay within the promised limits of the show. So I just want to say thank you so much, Dr. Crave, for coming on. You know, obviously Tyler and David have already expressed how much you meant to them. You've meant a heck of a lot to me too, in terms of your research. It's been tremendously beneficial. And, you know, I've kind of stated on the show, I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for your teachings on Molinism. There was a time I was an agnostic, and, you know, I needed to understand how God providentially works out the ultimate purpose for our lives. But yet there are these terrible things that happen in our lives and stuff like that through free will. So,
Well, thank you so much. You know, I don't know that I have ever been interviewed on the subject of God and time. And yet this is a subject that I am enamored with. And so I was very glad to accept this invitation. And I have enjoyed very much the conversation that we've had today.
Yes. And thank you, Dr. Greg. Again, like 90% of these books back here, you're in about 90% of them. So you did have a great impact on me and Dale, I know, especially, and even Tyler. So again, thank you so much. And we'd love to have you back and talk about this even further, because it's such a deep subject. And I think that Christians need to hear it. You know,
out of curiosity, Dr. Craig, if we set up kind of like a discussion, so like with another expert, would you be up for that on the issue?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Awesome.
Set it up.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, all right. That's it for our show. Coming up, we do have, is it Dr. Clay, Dr. David, it's your show.
Yes, Dr. Clay Jones of Biola. He's coming on about the problem of why God allows evil. And we're going to be talking about that because my thesis is on that, and I'm doing a philosophical theological response in mine. So I think it's got to be balanced, because my whole thing with that, and even Dr. Craig, you may want to say something to this, is that, you know, with the problem of general theism that the atheist uses to argue against God, I don't believe you can actually argue from a general theism, because for the same fact as you're taking from a specific tradition when you do that. So I'm trying to add a theological response to the problem of evil as well, and incorporating the philosophy.
Yes, I understand.
Okay.
All awesome. Right. Well, I'll look forward to being on the program again someday in the future.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Craig. Bye, guys. Have a good day. All right, y'all, that wraps it up. And with that being said, we also have a lot of videos coming up in May. Clay Jones is coming on May 3rd, as David said. May the 10th, then, we have Warren McGrew, Idol Killer, coming back on with Dr. Alan Rota to discuss what we were just discussing at the end there, the scriptural evidences for dynamic omniscience, a.k.a. open theism. And by the way, so since we do have a little bit of time, let me see, somebody, AES had said that that Dr. Ryan Mullins affirmed Molinism. Well, he just did a show with Idol Killer, so Warren, about why Molinist and Reformed Calvinist and Reformed everybody else should actually affirm dynamic omniscience. So with that being said, I think he may have changed his mind if he came out. I don't know. Can you affirm dynamic omniscience and still be a Molinist? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I would have to think a little bit more into it, but yeah. I agree. So far right now, I agree.
No, you're denying those, from my understanding of what Warren McGrew presented, you're denying those counterfactual, future tense counterfactual future freedom. So no, you can't.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I'm just thinking like maybe there's a reason that we haven't like maybe explored yet, but as far as I know, yeah, I think you're right.
Okay. Well, thank you, Awesome Lawson Clips, for the $5 super chat. We really appreciate that. And if anybody else wants to super chat us, please feel free. Or you can donate to us via PayPal, Venmo, or Cash App. And those links are in the description below. Other than Warren McGrew and Idol Killer on the May 13th, and this is going to be at 8 o'clock p.m., we are going to have Dr. Bo Branson and Father John Whiteford coming on to discuss justification from an Eastern Orthodox perspective. And we're going to have a conversation with the guys from Method Ministries. So both Lucas and Wesley. Lucas is a Methodist and Wesley is a Calvinist. Both are not both. One affirms the London Baptist Confession of Faith. And the other, I forget off the top of my head, Dane would know, but the Methodist Handbook, Doctrines and Dogmas or something to that effect. That'll be May 13th at 7 p.m. Or 8 p.m. Eastern, open discussion format. And then on the 17th is going to be one of my favorite episodes coming up. We've got Dr. David Bradshaw coming back on to discuss what we discussed here, except from an Orthodox perspective. So God and the philosophy of time and knowledge from an Orthodox perspective. But other than that, guys, that's about all I have.
Dear gosh, no. Tyler, the most important show.
Oh!
On 7 p.m., April 30th, on Tuesday night, with that amazing special guest, me.
Dale Glover.
but it is something that we've never done on Faith Unaltered, so I think it's important. We're addressing a Muslim objector who denies the crucifixion of Jesus as a historical fact on the basis of Surah 4, Ayah 157. Mm-hmm. So I am going to be refuting that Islamic claim. And then guess what? That's not it. So, you know, maybe you'll have to put up with my boring lecture for one night. But the treat is in May, and we've already got the date set.
May 21st.
We'll be debating and discussing with Dr. Shabir Ali. Again, a friend of mine, a great guy. And even though he's not a Christian, I respect him on the same level as Gary Habermas and William Craig or Mike Lacona. Shabir is someone who helped me in my religious journey. So even though in the end I disagree with him, he actually cares about helping save souls from his perspective and stuff. So yeah, we're going to be debating that crucifixion. And Shabir also agreed to have a discussion / minor debate with Dane on the issue of the Trinity in that same show as well. So that'll be great.
And that is Tuesday, May 21st at 7 p.m. So y'all, if you have not subscribed to Faith Unaltered or Real Seekers, you best do that, because here's the benefit of subscribing to both. Real Seekers actually produces content, and so does Faith Unaltered, that's exclusive to each other. We don't always produce the same shows. Now, whenever we do collab episodes, obviously we're together and we're broadcasting to both platforms, but Faith Unaltered and Real Seekers do post exclusive shows that are only, you can only get them if you're subscribed to both of our channels. So make sure y'all do that, and let's catch Dell up to the Faith Unaltered crew. We're like 3,000 ahead of him right now. So we need to catch Dell up. So if you're subscribed to Faith Unaltered but not Real Seekers, go subscribe to Real Seekers. Dell produces a lot of good content, mainly and specifically on the Shroud of Turin. And so that's, I know you're starting
and,
to...
And we had Otangelo.
Hey, and Christians are better together.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw Otangelo in there.
Hey, Christians are better together. So hey, just remember that with Dell and with us together, we're over 4,000 strong.
That's right. So with that being said, y'all have been great. Thank you all for the questions. Thank you for the super chat. And we will see you next time. David, I'm going to hit the intro. So until then, good night. Or the outro, I should say. Okay. Good night. God bless. And stay like Christ.